You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Tune into the DragonCon Report podcast, your ultimate destination for all things DragonCon.
Join us each month as we dive into our home away from home and cover the world of con fandom, cosplay, gaming, and more.
With guests each show, behind-the-scenes insights, tips and tricks, and the latest updates on this year's convention.
Whether you're a seasoned attendee or a first-time explorer,
the DragonCon Report is your passport to the ultimate geek experience.
Join us and let your inner dragon roar.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We're going to talk about a film this week that celebrated its 60th anniversary last year. It's one I wanted to get to last year, and with all the stuff that went on last year, as you know, didn't quite get to it, so we're getting to it today, a little late in celebrating its 60th birthday, but a film that made such an impact on me, and it has remained all these years. I first saw it on television in the mid to late 1960s. I was trying to find specifically the year that it was shown on television, and I'm making a guess that it was somewhere around 1966, maybe as late as early 1967. So I was either in the sixth or seventh grade when I saw The Haunting, directed by Robert Wise. It's a film that, if you talk to a lot of monster kids my age, we all pretty much have the same experience. This film absolutely affected us in an incredible way. I will never forget the first time I saw this film. I had vivid, vivid pictures in my mind of watching this film the first time. And, you know, you've heard me talk about, you know, my family had a little black and white portable TV. The screen was only about like 12 or 14 inches wide. And my mom and dad didn't mind if on a weekend I took it up into my room to watch a late night horror film, a monster movie or whatever. And this was one by CBS Late Movie. It was broadcast by them in their early days of showing movies late at night. And so it was all dark. I was in my bedroom all by myself, even with the little screen on it. And it's amazing, you know, as I think about it, how watching some of these monster movies and horror films on a little screen like that could really affect me. You know, I've gotten so spoiled by watching things now on a larger screen. But boy, was I affected by this film. I really was. This was a frightening film. And it was one that, and I'm going to make some comparisons of this film to Jaws, because it was like the less you saw, the more scary it got. And Robert Wise decided to take that approach to it. His mentor was Val Lewton, and he sort of made this film in memory of Val Lewton. And Lewton had told him at one time that, you know, the more you leave to the imagination of the audience, the more frightening it can be. And this film really, really proves that point. It is an incredible movie based on a Shirley Jackson novel, The Haunting of Hill House, not to be confused with a film we talked about a few months ago called The Legend of Hell House. And I got to admit, for a while there, sometimes I got them a little mixed up when I would see the Legend of Hell House, you know, being broadcast. So that was on Roddy McDowell. And then realized, oh, no, I want the one that's just called simply The Haunting. Because Robert Wise, when he'd read the book, fell in love with it, turned the book over to a guy who had written a lot of screen adaptations for him, Nelson Gidding, who was very well known for his adaptation, his screen adaptations. And Nelson does a great job on this. And we're going to get a little bit into that in just a minute, but I want to grab hold of this first-time experience. Again, somewhere around 1966, 1967, about three and a half years after it was released in the United States in the theater. What a film it was. And I like I said, I don't know many people my age or around my age haven't been affected by this film. And don't confuse it with the 1999 remake. The remake is okay, but compared to this film, it's not even close. Not even close. I was genuinely frightened during many portions of this movie the first time I saw it. So I was about 11 or 12 years old when I saw it. It was late at night in my bedroom, no lights on. Yeah, you know, the only thing that was lighting up the room was just the, you know, the screen of the portable TV set that I had. And I'll just right during the first scare of the movie. And there's several scenes we're going to talk about in this film. By the way, if you've not seen this movie, the 1963 version of The Haunting, in order to talk about this film, I'm going to spoil everything about it. You might want to read the book. It makes some changes to the book, but I think overall Nelson did a great job adapting that book to this. Shirley Jackson had mixed reviews about the movie, but she didn't hate it. She just it was sort of a middling approach to it, but audiences sure did. The movie was budgeted for $1.4 million. And over the years has made a ton of money. Initially, you know, in the theaters, it was a modest success. It wasn't a big blockbuster, but people never forgot this movie. They never forgot their experience with this movie. And it's funny, when I'm at a conventions and things like that, and we're talking about ghost movies and things of that nature, and this one always comes up. This was Martin Scorsese's favorite horror film. He puts it right up there on the top of his list. And it's a lot of people's favorite horror film. Now, growing up, I had an interest in ghost stories, and that led to looking for movies about ghosts. My mother's father, my maternal grandfather, told me, you know, some great stories. He was very interested in parapsychology and things of that nature. The farmhouse that he lived in and had lived in all his life, a nice big dairy farm in western Massachusetts, the one that my mother grew up in, was haunted, and I did see a ghost there. He had all kinds of books and photographs and things that he'd collected over the years. He was fascinated with the whole subject of parapsychology and ghosts and things of that nature. I later found out that on my father's side of the family, we had a distant relative who was a big psychic in Great Britain. His last name was Mann, T.E. Mann. And I received something from him in the mail many, many years ago. I think this was when we were still in Raleigh, if I'm not mistaken. You know, so I was, you know, high school age when I received it. And it dealt with I Ching and Tarot and astrology. And he had a way of reading Tarot and incorporating I Ching and astrology into the readings. And the Tarot cards, if you're familiar with Tarot, his cards were square, not rectangular. So I've got it on both sides of the family, and it's always been an interest of me, of mine, and still is to this day. I consider myself very spiritual, and that interest in parapsychology fits in quite well with it. So getting back to all of that, so I'd had this interest in ghosts, and two movies came to mind when I think back on my childhood as a monster kid. And one of them is this one, The Haunting, and the other one is 13 Ghosts. Another film that had quite an impact on me. I may go back and revisit that. Mark and I talked about 13 Ghosts in season number one, and that is a film that also had quite an impact on me, and I vividly remember not the first time I saw it, because I saw that during the daytime on Monster Movie Matinee. It was on a Saturday afternoon. But the first time I saw it at night with the little black and white TV up in my room, and it was a totally different experience. And so these were the two films that I would always always remember as being, you know, some of the, my favorite ghost movies. And I've found some others along the way, you know, as I got to be, you know, a young adult and then later on a full-fledged adult, you know, and I've got some favorites. But growing up, definitely, this one was number one as far as one of the scariest ghost movies I had ever seen. And dealing with this old house, Hill House, that had stood for 90 years. The people in the city nearby, they considered it haunted. But, you know, it's never really brought out. We're going to tell you a little bit more about that when we get into the story. So, you know, nobody ever really comes out and says, no, this house is haunted. But you just get that feeling. You just get that feeling. First, I want to talk about the cast. And I'm going to talk about very few actors in this because really the story itself just centers around very few people. Led by Julie Harris. Julie Harris, an American actress, was the perfect casting for the role of Eleanor Vance. Now, it's funny, most of the names from the book are kept by Nelson Gidding, except for one, and we're going to talk about that one in just a minute. Julie Harris, incredible actress, known a lot for her stage work. She had won 10 Tony Awards. She was a Sarah Siddons Award recipient for her work on stage in Chicago. She earned awards in everything that she did acting-wise and also had quite a good career in film and television work. And she's perfect for this, absolutely perfect, as Eleanor Vance, who is, I want to say, sort of a sheltered individual. She finds out about this research that's going to be done at Hill House, and she had an experience with the poltergeist, we find out, in the film. Early on, and just sort of a mention, and that's what draws the attention of the researcher. And he says, "Yeah, you can come along on the research that I'm going to do, Dr. John Markway." Now, this is the only name that was changed from the book. In the book, it's Dr. Montague. All the other characters are pretty much the same names as they were in Shirley Jackson's book. But Markway invites Eleanor, known as Nell, that was her nickname, and that's what she'll be called throughout the film, invites her to join them at this mansion, out in the middle of nowhere. And every time that Nell asks questions about, you know, finding this house and that sort of thing, the reaction she gets from the people nearby leads you to believe that the people in this nearby town sort of consider it to be evil. They don't like talking about it. There are two caretakers that have been looking after the house. It's been deserted forever. It has quite a history, a lot of deaths that have occurred there. We'll get into that with the timeline. Now, a lot of the people I'm going to talk about in this film, unless you watch a lot of British television or British films, you may not recognize them. Some came over here to the United States and had a successful careers. But Robert Wise, who we remember for, oh my God, so many great, great films. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, the work that this man has done, even you know, amongst monster kids and sci-fi fans, you know, film that we're probably going to talk about here sometime this season. He directed the first Star Trek motion picture, but The Sound of Music, West Side Story, which he was working on when he got a hold of the book, The Legend of Hill House, and read it and said, hey, I like this. The Andromeda Strain, you know, just to name a few. The man had quite a career in motion pictures. And he does an incredible job on this. He really, really does. Now, he had just finished up on West Side Story when he jumped into this. And he got together with Nelson Gidding, and Nelson put together a screenplay for him with a little influence from Robert, but he pretty much left Nelson on his own. And they took the project to MGM, and MGM didn't really like it, turned him down. Then Nelson got the idea of, let's take this to England, because England had and we've talked about this in some other films, had this tax structure, this levy, that ended up becoming pretty much the British Film Institute's organization, because England, like many countries over in Europe and Canada, also does this. The government finances films that they approve of, you know, to help independent filmmakers make movies. Now, we haven't quite gotten to that point here in the United States, but I wish we would. Speaking as an aspiring filmmaker. Got a couple of projects I would love to pitch to the government if they would help finance them. So Robert Wise took it to the United States. I took it to Great Britain, and we've talked about other films that had done that. You know, it took some American actors over there. And of course, Great Britain had a restriction that you had to have so many British performers in your film to qualify for it, you know, cast and crew, which leads to some of the other people we're going to be telling you about here in just a second. And he took it to MGM over there, and they gave him the equivalent of $1.4 million to shoot the film. And Wise wanted to shoot it in black and white, and it turned out that worked out well, because he was going to have to shoot it in black and white. But he did something a little interesting, and I'm going to get back to Julie Harris and the rest here in just a minute. Wise wanted this look for the film. He wanted to give it sort of a little bit of an odd look, and it really does. I think this is the one thing that helps enhance the frightening aspects of the movie. Went to the folks that developed the Panavision lens, the wide-angle lens. They had a 40-millimeter lens that initially Robert Wise was going to use to give it the look he was after, but it wasn't quite what he wanted. And then he found out that they were working on a 30-millimeter lens, but it wasn't finished. But Wise loved the way it made things look. Sort of a fisheye type. Not over exaggerated, but I call it, you know, sort of like a little bit of a fisheye look. Rounds out things a little bit. But it just gave everything a little bit of a weird look. And the company said, well, you're going to have to like come out publicly and say you realize that this lens has not been perfected. You're working with a lens that is sort of an early version or whatever. And Wise says, fine, whatever. I just want to use this. And it really does a job on this. It really looks. So if you see a version of the film now, and you can find it. Here we go again. Jim and his Prime Video. Yeah, Amazon Prime Video has it. It's going to cost you about $4. It's worth it if you haven't seen it. I will say that. It's incredible. And over the years, the appreciation this film has gotten from people, from other generations of me, people younger than me that came up and were exposed to this film, it's been incredible. And a lot of people consider this one of the best horror movies and the best, you know, spooky movies or ghost movies ever made. And I'm right up there with them. You know, I give this film like a 9 out of 10 on IMDb. It's really an incredible film. So Wise gets the look he wants. He finds a mansion that he can shoot exteriors on. I think when I first saw this, I wasn't sure if it was a matte painting or not, but it's real. Now that I've seen it in 4K, I can tell that, you know, he used a real location. But everything else is shot on stage. And they are beautiful, absolutely beautiful, and include one room in this mansion that they spend a lot of time in, the library, that contains one of the most frightening props I've ever seen. Now, you know, many of you know, and I've mentioned this, that, you know, for the last several years of my adult life, you know, I've developed a fear of heights. And I think some of that is probably from the fact that I have diabetes type 2, and I have neuropathy as a result of that. And so my balance has gotten worse over the years because of the neuropathy in my feet. Because it's hard to explain, but those of you that have diabetes know what I'm talking about. It's you feel like you're sort of walking on pillows or whatever. You just, it's really hard to get stable. And they have a prop in this library that's a spiral staircase, a metal spiral staircase. I want to call it sort of freestanding, which is sort of a common thing in these old, you know, old library rooms or whatever. Because you can't put a regular staircase in to get to the top shelves of where the books are, because it's impractical. So you have to do a spiral staircase so you can get up in a hurry. And Wise did some really cool things with this. He made the rail of this spiral staircase. He was able to convert it into a track for a handheld camera, so he could track a camera up and down it. It really gives it some great, great looks in the film. Great looks. Some really screwy, spooky looks. And he also attached a cable to it so it might shake around a little bit. When the cable's not pulled, the thing is, the staircase is locked into this pole. That's like, you know, its main brace, keep it freestanding. But when he pulls the cable a certain way, it's loose. So if you're on it, it's going to shake a little bit back and forth. It's perfectly safe. But I'll tell you what, I wouldn't do it. If I was an actor, back then during the shooting of that movie, I couldn't have done it with the fear of heights that I have right now and the balance problems that I have right now. But boy, does it make for some scary scenes in this movie, where Julie Harris's character, Nell, nearly falls off of it a couple of times. And Russ Tamblyn's character does. Oh, yeah, Russ Tamblyn's in this. We're going to talk about him here in a second. So anyway, that's just some of the things coming your way. Our next actress, and there's really only three women, four actually, but three main women in this film. Claire Bloom plays Theodora, who they refer to as Theo. And Claire Bloom, I will always remember for the film The Illustrated Man. Beautiful, beautiful lady. We've talked about her from other projects. She had quite a film career here in the United States. I think the last time we talked about Claire Bloom was later on in her career. She appeared in Clash of the Titans. And she's with us. She's with us. She's in her 90s right now, in her mid-90s. But Clash of the Titans, The Haunting, The King's Speech, a few years back. Limelight from one of her 1952 movies. Altogether, 127 films. And she was on a television series called Doc Martin, which ran from 2005 to 2022. 5 episodes of that. So, I mean, she's still acting, at least up until 2 years ago. Midsummer Murders, those have gotten very popular. I see them streaming all the time, that TV series. Did an episode of that. So she's had quite a career over several decades. She even appeared on Law and Order. So, you know, she must be famous. And she's great in this. There's a hint of her character possibly being gay, but it's never really thrown out there. Again, this is 1963. The novel was written in 1959. So that's sort of a controversial subject back then. But it's hinted at. She dresses very mod for the 60s, for 1963. And it's a nice trade-off with her and Nell, Theo and Nell. Nell, and I never really did finish with Julie Harris's character, so let's finish off that, is very sheltered. She spent most of her adult life caring for her mother, and her mother has just died. And she has some feelings of guilt about that. And anyone who's ever had to take care of a parent for any length of time, and I speak from experience on that, you do experience that. You know, in this case, it was my mom, and it was her mother in the film. You know, and when the parent dies, there is that you have to go through as part of the grieving process where you feel guilty, even though you were a caretaker for many, many years. So it brings a nice element to her character. One of the reasons Julie Harris took the role was she felt the character was so deep, and it's a very deep character. All of these character actors are in this. But the story does seem to center around Nell. And when Neil Gidding wrote the adaptation, he wrote it more as Nell's character losing her mind than of anything of the paranormal. So when he took the story idea and the script to Shirley Jackson just to show what he'd done, she said, well, no, the story in the book that I wrote is very paranormal, but I'm intrigued with what you've done. So, it's an interesting element to bring to the character. And it is so that during this film, there is that element that you're not sure if Nell's just losing her mind or if there really is a lot of paranormal stuff going on. Well, when I first saw this, and for many viewings after that, I always took it from the point of view of the paranormal. But this last viewing of it, less than a week ago when I watched it, I did sort of let myself fall into that other realm where it's like, well, yeah, maybe some of this was in her mind. But I think the movie, as it's presented to audiences, even today, I think pretty much tries to tell you, no, this is paranormal. There's something very strange going on in this house. So you've got this very sheltered character opposite Claire Bloom's character, Theo. And it really is a nice trade-off. Nice, nice contrast to the two of them. Now, Dr. Markway is played by a British actor by the name of Richard Johnson. We lost Richard just a few years ago in 2015. And again, this is going to be probably the most popular American film that you remember him for. Richard pretty much was known almost exclusively for British films, except for one horror film. The 1979 horror film Zombie, Fulci's film. He does play a main character in that. Not a zombie, but he plays a doctor in that. And Richard does a great, he does a great job on this, playing Dr. Markway. And he credits his performance to Robert Wise, who he said gave him such great advice and guidance on how to perform this character. Because Richard always played this kind of character, I won't say authoritative, but, like a researcher, like a scientist, like a doctor. But he's got an element to this that's almost, and it, like I said, it's very underplayed, which is good. Almost an obsession with this house. He wants a haunted house to investigate. And he makes it very clear in the beginning of the movie. There's one younger Crane, still alive, character by the name of Luke Sanderson, and he stands to inherit the house. That's played by Russ Tamlin. And, of course, we remember Russ Tamlin, West Side Story, which, again, so that connection with Robert Wise, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, of course, The Haunting, of course, a lot of people my age will remember him for a film that came out in 1958 that our folks took us to when we were kids, called Tom Thumb. And you've heard me talk about, I am a direct relative of Tom Thumb's, the Tom Thumb who toured with P.T. Barnum, of his wife. His wife is I won't say a distant ancestor, but like a great-great-grandmother of mine. Direct line with my mom's family. My mom's grandmother was the sister of Tom Thumb's wife, Lavinia Warren Bump. They toured with P.T. Barnum for many years, as well as Lavinia's sister, who was also a little person. They all toured together. So I remember that movie as a kid. The movie Tom Thumb was more about the fairy tale version or whatever. But that's how Russ got his start as a kid. And then has been in and out of films on American television and in American film cinema for many, many years. And his daughter, Amber Tamlin, is quite a successful actress as well. And initially he plays his character, Luke, is a bit of a jerk. And at first, Russ Tamlin wasn't going to do the part. But he owed a film to MGM, and they said, no, you're going to do it. You're going to do it. And then when he went back and read the script again, he says, well, it is a good script. And he saw the value in Luke's character. And, yeah, he is sort of a jerk. But he said the role won him over, and he does a very good job with this. He does a very good job of this. Now, the only people that are in the house then You only got four people that are in the house during this research, and that is Luke, Dr. Markway, Theo, and Nell. There were supposed to be two others that Dr. Markway invited, but they changed their minds at the last minute, wouldn't show up. Now, one other character one other actress you're going to see that you will recognize, if you're a James Bond fan, who isn't? And that's Lois Maxwell, who played Miss Moneypenny for many, many years in a bunch of James Bond films, in the early James Bond films. And she plays the wife of Dr. Markway, Grace, who shows up later on in the film, near the end. She shows up to see what's going on. So you got the four of them in this house. Now, what has happened in this house over the years? Like I said, a lot of strange things have happened in this house. A lot of death. After the house is first built 90 years ago by a fellow by the name of Hugh Crane, Hugh Crane's wife died when the carriage she's riding in crashes into a big tree by the house as she's approaching the house for the first time. So it sets things in motion right from the beginning. Well, Crane goes out and gets married again, but his second wife is killed when she falls down the stairs in the house. Breaks her neck. Now, Crane's daughter, Abigail, lives in the house for the rest of her life. Never moves. Never moves out. Never moves out of the nursery that she was raised in. That nursery room. She never, never leaves the house. Played by Faye Compton. Again, another longtime British character actress who you might recognize. But Abigail, so is living in this house. In the nursery room where she was, you know, raised as an infant, never leaves the room, and she has a nurse companion, and Abigail needs some help one night while the nurse companion is having a little tete-a-tete with her boyfriend down in one of the other rooms, and she dies. The companion inherits the house, but is later found hanged from this spiral staircase we're talking about in the library. She commits suicide. And that's how it comes into the possession of Mrs. Sanderson, who never moves into the house. The house remains empty all that time. Luke stands to inherit it when his mother dies. And so, as I said, you know, Luke sort of comes off as a little bit of a jerk. He's only interested in how much the house is worth, what he can get out of it. We get the impression he's sort of an irresponsible guy, freewheeling, but we sort of warm up to him as this house starts affecting everybody. And now let's get into some of the things that makes this movie the movie it is. Nell is the first one to get there. She meets the Dudleys, who are the caretakers. Mr. Dudley, played by Valentine Dial, and his wife, played by Rosalie Crutchley. She looked very familiar to me, even as a kid. I'd seen her somewhere, and she'd done some American television. Mr. Dudley, I didn't recognize at all. Valentine pretty much did a lot of voiceover work in Great Britain. Was a recurring character on a long-running British television show. And I don't remember him doing much here in the United States, if anything at all. But she has a very interesting look. She will not stay in the house after dark. Neither will he. He's the caretaker, and she takes care of the house. She also prepares all the meals for the four of them that are staying there, but tells them breakfast is at 9 a.m. because I won't come into the house before that. I'll make your lunch. I'll leave you dinner, and I will leave before it gets dark. So once I leave, you know, if you need any help, I'm not going to be available. So the very first night that Nell and Theo and Dr. Markway and Luke are there, Eleanor, whose bedroom adjoins Theo's, with the door, we start hearing some weird noises. And this is the thing that really got to me. And Nell and Theo end up in the same room. They end up in Theo's room holding each other because there is noise going on outside the door. And the way that Robert Wise shoots this is brilliant. When I think of this film, and when I think about it over the years from seeing it as a kid, this is what I always remember is the shot of this door and something smashing on the door, I mean, trying to get in. and a noise that I can hardly explain. I mean, the sound guys went to town on this one. You can't see it, but you can hear it. And Wise brings you in so quickly on this film. I'm sitting there watching this in my bedroom at night with no lights on a little TV set, a little black and white TV set. And this really gets to me. The thought of being in a room, trapped in a room, and this thing smashing on the door trying to get in. You don't know if it's an animal or what it is. And it terrifies Nell and Theo. Now, Theo, we come to find out, has the ability of reading people very well. I'm not going to call her a psychic per se. She's never referred to as that, or a mind reader, but she just can read people extremely accurately, which really offsets Nell quite a bit. She doesn't trust her. And it sort of gets, you know, Markway and Luke, you know, they're a little uncomfortable around her. But Markway knows that she can be very valuable if the stories, the ghost stories of this house are true. So we have that incident. And, of course, Markway and Luke, you know, talk about, well, no, they didn't see anything or hear anything. We also find out that the way this house was built, there are it's never squared off. None of the corners are squared off. It's at a slight angle. And this is why Robert Wise wanted the lens that he uses in this film. Doors close themselves by themselves and open themselves by themselves, which adds to the spookiness. Now, I'm not going to give you a complete blow-by-blow of all of the things that happen, but over the series of the next few days, a lot does happen. Now, we find out that Nell can't go into the library. They open that room up, and the minute she takes one step in, she smells something, and she leaves immediately and gets violently ill and says, that's the smell that I smelled in my mother's room all those years. It's the smell of death and sickness. And little by little, this house starts getting to her. That's where Julie Harris really liked this role, because she could really, really stretch her chops on this. And so she slowly becomes obsessed with this house. She has an instant, and we also have an incident with Luke up on this spiral staircase where he's only about 10 feet in the air at the time that he loses his balance and falls off the staircase. And we've got another instance where right after Eleanor has this experience with the library, which is a really weird place, she nearly falls off one of the parapets of the mansion, and she's looking upward at one of the towers, and Markway gets her just in time to catch her before she falls off. So another instance where Markway says, okay, Theo and Eleanor need to stay in the same room. So they push the two beds from the two rooms together. And Eleanor wakes up. She hears the voice of a guy just speaking. And then she hears a woman laughing. So Eleanor says, Theo, hold my hand. But all of a sudden, the grip comes tighter and tighter and tighter. She says, no, you're hurting my hand. You're hurting my hand. And then she hears the sound of a young girl crying. That wakes her up. And Theo wakes up and finds that Eleanor has moved out of the bed over onto a nearby couch. And then Eleanor, really looking at her hand, like, whose hand was I holding? Just adding to the craziness of this house. Now, is it Eleanor going crazy, or is it something paranormal? Well, I'm going to always believe it's paranormal, because you had the instance with the thing trying to crash into the door, and that happens more than once, and the others get a chance to experience that as well. But to complicate things, Eleanor starts not only becoming obsessed with the house, she develops some feelings for Dr. Markway. But what she doesn't realize is that the Markway's married. But she finds out because Grace Markway shows up. Now, Grace isn't a believer in the paranormal. We find out, you know, she's very, you know, I won't say authoritative, but, you know, she's a strong woman. Doesn't really believe what Markway's doing, but she said, hey, I'm going to stay. She wanted to warn him that a reporter has learned about the investigation and maybe showing up there, and she wanted to head him off at the pass. And she said she'll be a part of the group for the rest of the investigation. Markway initially doesn't want her to stay, but She says, no, I will stay there, and I'm not only going to stay there, but I'm going to stay in the nursery room that you guys are talking about. And Marco said, wait, he says, I'm determined that this is sort of at the center of all of the paranormal activity that's happening in this house. But Grace says, nope, I'm going to stay there. I'm going to stay there. And that night, all kinds of weirdness is going on and strange noises. And to make a long story short, Grace disappears. Luke gets to the room investigating all this noise, and she's not there. Eleanor gets there. She's gone. Not Eleanor, but Grace is gone. They do a room-by-room search, and they can't find Grace. They know she's got to be there somewhere. But this is a weird house where you can get lost very easily. As we found out very early on, when Nell and Theo first try to get from their bedrooms to the dining room where their dinner is, and they almost get lost in the house. There's all of the doors. They all look the same. Well, their investigation into Grace's disappearance takes them to the nursery, to the library. And this is where Nell sort of loses it. And again, I'm skipping over a lot, folks. This film is so rich. If you haven't seen it and you're still listening to this, even though I'm spoiling it, you got to watch this movie. Nell ends up climbing the spiral staircase and it's shaking and all that. Julie Harris said she was terrified. It was a very difficult part of the film to do. And we have learned along the way that two people on the spiral staircase at one time can be very dangerous. The way this thing sometimes sort of flops around if you put too much weight on it. But Markway's got to go up there. There's a little landing up there at the top that the stairway is attached to. And Nell makes it up there. And she's sort of leaning out over the landing and stuff over the rail. Markway is terrified that she's going to fall off and kill herself. And he manages to get up there. And the staircase holds together. And just as he gets up there and starts helping Eleanor back down the stairway, Eleanor looks up and this trap door from above opens up and this face can be seen, and then the door slams shut and Nell just loses it. And they get her off the spiral staircase, and she said, it was Grace. It was Grace. And Marco says, no, it couldn't have been her. There's no way. She says, it was Grace. I'm telling you, it was Grace. And that's it for Marco. He says, you've got to go. This is too much for you. Too much for you. Puts her in her, you know, gets her things together, puts her in her car, and says, we'll finish this off, but this is just too much for you. And as she's driving down, now, it's hard to explain. This is I call it a driveway, but it's a long, 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 long driveway and like a one, you know, car dirt road that winds and you know, very curvy through this forest that surrounds the mansion. And Nell's driving and she feels like someone's grabbed the wheel, and she's fighting the wheel of this little car she's driving. And again, is Nell just losing it, or is there something paranormal happening here? There is that, you know, again, that element. I think it was paranormal. And all of a sudden she looks up and she sees a woman running across the little road, and to avoid her, she turns the wheel very quickly and smashes into a big tree. Car flips over, and by the time Markway and Luke and Theo get up there, she's dead. It's the same tree that Abigail Crane crashed into with the carriage 90 years ago. Wow. And then Grace shows up, and she's all disheveled, and she's confused, and she says, I don't know what happened. She said, I was hearing noises, something strange, and everything went dark. And I got lost, which can, like I said, can happen very easily in that house. And next thing I know, I found myself in the attic, and I didn't know how I got there. And I opened up the trap door, and then I saw Eleanor, and she scared me when she screamed out. And the next thing I know, I'm walking around here in the woods, and I see the car coming right at me, and it crashes into the tree. Theo remarks that, well, Eleanor got what she wanted. She wanted to stay in the house. She'd been in, you know, there'd been a couple of times that Markway said, look, I think maybe we need to send you home. I think this is too much for you. And she just kept insisting, no, I need to be here. I need to be at this house. You know, and is it because She had been chained up, taking care of her mother all those years, and now she's finally free and on her own. We do find out in the beginning of the movie that she's got a sister and a brother-in-law who are very possessive, sort of handcuffing her from doing anything. Is it because she's finally doing something on her own or what? Or is there really something in this house that's reaching out for her? We don't know. But we see a final shot of the house. And of course, Luke's like, you know what? I think we ought to just burn this house down and I'm going to spread salt all over it. I think that there is evil here with all the stuff that we've experienced during this investigation. And then we hear a narration that we heard in the beginning of the film explaining about the history of the house and Abigail Crane, except this time the person doing the narration is Eleanor, who is now a permanent resident, apparently, of Hill House. Folks, what I just gave you there is not even, you know, there's so much more. And all of these different little scenes and stuff that are so disturbing. Oh, my goodness. And watching this film for, you know, a few days ago, it's still just as powerful as it was. I think the last time I'd seen it was maybe about a year and a half ago because I thought I wanted to do this for Monster Attack. This one I've been holding on to, and then this just seemed to be the week to do it. One of the best ghost stories ever told on film. And Robert Wise says this is one of his favorite films as well. Not only was it one of his favorite films, he said it was one of his favorite filmmaking experiences. He loved directing this movie. He said it was a great experience. So I can't recommend enough watching 1963's The Haunting. Now you can go ahead and see the one that came out in 1999. It's okay, but it doesn't even come close to matching up to this one. So I wish they wouldn't try to reboot these classics because you never quite get it right. Wes Craven originally was going to make that reboot, and he backed out of the project at the last minute because, I don't know, something bugged him about it. Yeah, Wes probably, you know, grew up with this film like the rest of us did. It's a great movie, folks. And again, growing up as a kid, two movies came to mind when it came to ghost stories. This one, The Haunting, and 13 Ghosts. And nothing else came close to it except for maybe The Uninvited, which we talked about, I think it's season 2 or season 3, which is another favorite of mine. But I saw that I was much older when I saw that one. But 1 and 2 is The Haunting and 13 Ghosts. And we may have to revisit 13 Ghosts again. I just saw that again the other night when it ran on Svengoolie. I'd forgotten how much I loved that film. So folks, check it out. 1963's The Haunting, an all-time classic. Hey, folks, we'll be back with you again next Monday with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Shane and Madeline are going to be with us in just a couple of weeks. We're going to be talking about a Godzilla film that they're going to be showing at their next Silver Screen Spook Show. So it's going to be a fun show. Always great when we get Madeline and Shane here. Mark will be joining us again, and we got to get Clay and the gang together. And we do have a convention coming up in August. I'll give you a little advance publicity on that. August 9th, 10th, and 11th, here in the Atlanta area, Monsterama. Martine Bestwick will be there. Victoria Vetri will be there. Our friend Elizabeth Shepherd, I can't wait to see Elizabeth again. She's coming back. Sam Irvin, Clint Howard. We got a good, nice lineup of folks that are going to be there for Monsterama. So put it down your calendar, August 9th, 10th, and 11th. And, of course, the whole Monster Attack gang will be there this year. We got to see if we can talk them into letting us do a Monster Attack panel again because we had a lot of fun with that. So we'll be talking about that some more on and on as it gets closer and closer to it. Folks, have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.
Lighter here, inviting you to join Cletus Jacobs and I every week as we dive deeper into the dawn of DC. We review DC comics, television, movies, and more. We're excited to finish the final season of Doom Patrol, return to Sweet Tooth for its second season, and check out the Netflix series Bodies. Get all your DC news on the Earth Station DCU podcast, part of the ESO Network.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.